Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 1, observing the armies, text number 3. Paishaitam pandu putranam acharya mahitim chamum yudam drupada putrena tavashishena dimata paisha. Behold, etam, this, Panduputranam, of the sons of Pandu, Acharya, O teacher, Mahitim, great, Shamum, military force, Yudam, arranged, Drupada, Putrena, by the son of Drupada, Tava, your Shishena, disciple, Dimata, very intelligent. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. O my teacher, behold the great army of the sons of Pandu, so expertly arranged by your intelligent disciple, the son of Drupada. Do we have a translation today? Oh, okay. Purport. Duryodhana, a great diplomat, wanted to point out the defects of Dronacharya, the great Brahmin commander-in-chief. Dronacharya had some political quarrel with King Drupada, the father of Draupadi, who was Arjuna's wife. As a result of this quarrel, Drupada performed a great sacrifice by which he received the benediction of having a son who would be able to kill Dronacharya. Dronacharya knew this perfectly well, and yet as a liberal brahmana, he did not hesitate to impart all his military secrets when the son of Drupada, Dhrishtadyumna, was entrusted to him for military education. Now in the battle of Kurukshetra, Dhrishtadyumna took the side of the Pandavas, and it was he who arranged for their military phalanx, after having learned the art from Dronacharya. Duryodhana pointed out this mistake of Dronacharya's so that he might be alert and uncompromising in the fighting. By this he wanted to point out also that he should not be similarly lenient in the battle against the Pandavas, were also Dronacharya's affectionate students. Arjuna especially was his most affectionate and brilliant student. Duryodhana also warned that such leniency in the fight would lead to defeat. So the text again, Paishetam pandu putranam acharyam mahitim chamum yudam drupada putrena tavashishena dimata. O my teacher, behold the great army of the sons of Pandu, so expertly arranged by your intelligent disciple, the son of Drupada. This book called the Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavad means opulence, and Gita means singing. So this song, this is a, in the form of a book, historically it was a conversation between two people. One of them was called Bhagavan, and the other was his disciple, friend, Arjuna. And this conversation takes place on a battlefield 5,000 years ago. And Arjuna had to fight against many very important warriors at that time. It was a big battle. Arjuna was on one side, along with his brothers, and someone called Duryodhana, who was his cousin, and his brothers were on the other side. And there were many, many people on the battlefield. So Arjuna had affection for his cousins and other people he had to fight against, and he became very disturbed. And although he was a warrior and it was his duty to fight, he was becoming very disturbed and he didn't want to fight. But his friend Krishna was on the chariot with Arjuna, his chariot driver, and Krishna, according to the Bhagavad Gita, is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and therefore he explained to Arjuna why he should fight. Now, the Bhagavad Gita is the most elementary book in what's called the Vedic literature that we have. In other words, it has the most simple philosophy, but it's, for most of us, it's quite complicated because it's so simple. Generally, we're used to hearing things that make no sense, and then we're taught to memorize them, and then after we memorize them, we forget about them because they didn't make any sense to begin with. They have no application to our lives. But Bhagavad Gita is actually dealing directly with what we're experiencing, but because what we're experiencing is partly called illusion, therefore it's hard to understand exactly what Krishna is talking about. In any case, Arjuna will become very disturbed and he'll decline to fight, but then he'll ask Krishna what he should do. So Bhagavad Gita is really meant for people who are inquisitive about a number of things. One of them is why we're not happy, why we're suffering. Everyone wants to be happy. No one does things to suffer, unless they're crazy. And then their happiness is in suffering. They take pleasure in suffering. But generally speaking, people are working in order to become as happy as possible for as long as possible. And generally, knowledge is to help us become happy. For instance, one goes to a university and may learn so many things that are irrelevant to one's life, except for the fact that if you get a degree, then you can get a good job, and with a good job you can get money, and with money you can buy things like a house and cars and clothes, and so that's relevant. Exactly what we're learning in school may not be relevant, but the money is relevant that we can earn from the degree or from the job. But this particular knowledge is relevant because it has to do with our very selves. Why we're not happy, although we want to be happy. Why we're suffering, although we don't want to suffer. Who are we? So Krishna answers the questions one after another. And the first thing Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita is, Dehnosmi nita dehe kamaram yovanam jara tita dahantara praptir tiryas tatra namuyati. As the embodied soul is continually passing in a body, which is going from boyhood to youth to old age, so similarly the soul will enter into another body at the time of death. The self-realized souls are not bewildered by all these different changes. In other words, we're in a body, but the body is only temporary. It's always changing. It may not seem to change right in front of our eyes, but in the course of time we can see the changes. Obviously we're not exactly the same as when we were in the womb of our mother, and we're not the same as when we were 1 year old or 5 years old or 10 years old, nor will we be the same in 10 years if we're still in this body. The body won't be the same. But the person who identifies themselves with the body, or the persons who identify themselves with their body, they're the same. In other words, when we were 1 year old, we thought we were the 1 year old body. And when we were 10 years old, we thought we were the 10 year old body. And we're now thinking we're this body. But if the body's different, how can the person who identifies the body be different? Because he's the same. If he were different, he would know he had a different body. But because he's continually changing his bodies, but he identifies himself with every body he has, Therefore, he's the same. He's the only thing that's, but the body's different. And our minds are different too. But the person identifies themselves with the mind, they're the same. So therefore, the conclusion is that although the body is always changing, and the soul, we're the soul, by the way, we're the soul who's conscious, just like this table. Now I hit the table, but the table doesn't complain because it doesn't have any feelings. But if I went up to Lalita Govinda and I started to hit him, he'd probably complain because he's conscious.
No.
Toshan Krishna would definitely complain. Because we're conscious and therefore we have feelings. We're aware of things. But these floor was sitting on, the walls, they're unconscious. Now because the soul is in the body, therefore there's consciousness because the soul has consciousness. But when the soul leaves the body, because the soul is the source of consciousness, therefore the body has no consciousness. It's like a puppet. You may put your hand in a puppet and it may move because your hand is in there, but if you take your hand out, then the puppet doesn't move anymore. But no one says that the puppet is dead. They may say the puppet's dead if they're really attached to the puppet, but no one takes the puppet and goes to the puppet burial ground and buries the puppet. And everyone cries and says it was a wonderful puppet, put on so many good shows, but now it's dead and we're supposed to bury it. Because the puppet was never alive, therefore there's no question of burying the puppet. Similarly, the body is not alive. It's only because we're in the body that we think it's alive. But when the soul leaves the body, then we see the body was never alive. It's dead. So we can't die. The body can't die because it was never alive. Something that was never alive can't die. And something that was never dead, was always alive, can't die. So we can't die, nor can the body be alive. It's always dead. Sorry for the unfortunate information that our body is already dead. And besides that, whatever body we have now is completely different from the body we had a minute ago, actually. Everything has changed. If you believe the scientists, every atom in the body has changed. The electrons have moved. The blood has circulated. The cells are changing. So at every moment we have a different body. So the body we had 1 minute ago is dead. It disappeared. But we don't find people falling down the ground crying, "My body from a minute ago disappeared. Where is it? Please bring it back. I really like that body." So this is Krishna's first instruction, that the soul is eternal, but the body's temporary. It's not that it doesn't exist, it just only exists for a moment. Then it changes. Now, because we're identified with the body, that's our problem. That's our main problem. Because no one wants to die. And the body has to die. And if we think we're the body, then we think we have to die. So that's a big anxiety. Therefore, the only solution to, first of all, to become happy is to realize we're not the body. Then we won't be in anxiety about having to die. Because we're never going to die, but we think we are, but that's the problem, that we think we're going to die. And that's as good as suffering, death. So the question is, why is it that the soul, who's eternal, is now in a body, and while we're in the body, we're in an illusion. Just like when we get into a car, generally speaking, no one thinks that they're the car. Unless they're really attached to the car, then they really get absorbed in the car consciousness. And if someone hits the car, then they get out of the car and they say, "You hit me, you hit me." They calm down, "We didn't hit you, we hit your car." "But you hit me, it's my car." So similarly, because we're identified with the body, therefore we suffer whatever happens to the body. Or we become proud if something nice happens to the body, we think it's happening to me. But it's just like watching a movie and identifying oneself with the hero. Maybe it's a movie about Romeo and Juliet. So then someone may think they're Romeo or Juliet. Or maybe nowadays they think they're both Romeo and Juliet. So, but we're not Romeo, we're not Juliet. Romeo doesn't become my wife, or Juliet doesn't become my, Romeo doesn't become my husband, and Juliet doesn't become my wife. That these things are simply our imagination, that we become identified with the characters in the movie or in the play, and we feel, if the hero is killed, then we feel bad. If the hero is victorious, we feel good. Similarly, this body is just like a dream. As I said before, we get up in the morning and we look into the mirror and we ask the mirror, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the greatest of them all?" But and the mirror, of course, the answer is, "My dear soul, due to your pious activities in so many lifetimes, now you're seeing the Supreme Person within the mirror. So please render that person unalloyed, uninterrupted service today." So then we become enthusiastic. And we're convinced that the goal of my life is to serve that deity in the mirror to the best of my ability. So then we dress the deity, we clothe the deity, we bathe the deity, we feed the deity, and then we go out into the world to spread the glories of the deity to everyone, try to get devotees for our deity. So actually everyone is a deity worshiper. Everyone is worshiping their deity in the form of their present material body and trying to get devotees for the deity. People who can serve the deity, appreciate the deity, love the deity, take care of the deity. Even when the deity gets old and ugly, we still want the deity to be taken care of because it's our deity. We love it anyhow. So that's called, according to our philosophy, it's called illusion. So how to get out of the illusion and why we're in the illusion, that's why the Bhagavad Gita was spoken. First of all, let us know that we're eternal and that only due to illusion that we're unhappy. And that what is the process by which one is put into illusion and what's the process by which one can free himself from illusion. So the second main part of the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita is that the reason why we're put into illusion is because we want to be an illusion. Because we want to be something we're not. And what does everyone want to be? They want to be the supreme. Everyone wants to be the center of someone's attention. Someone sees ourselves as supreme. If it's not our husband, then maybe it's our children, or our dog, or our goldfish. Someone has to see us as the center of their attention. And what's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that if you don't mind having a material body. But The second part of the philosophy is that there's a Supreme Person. That's Krishna is one of the names for the Supreme Person. That is, everything comes from someone. Now, nowadays, if you read most literatures, they say, yes, everything came from something, and usually they say everything came out of nothing. That it all came out of nothing. You've heard that philosophy before? In the beginning, there was nothing, and nothing got bored. After all, it was good for nothing. But everything has a mother, so mother nothing had a mother too, mother nothing. So mother nothing told son nothing, why don't you become something? You're an embarrassment. You're good for nothing. So nothing thought about it for a long time because nothing had nothing to do except to think about why he's nothing. So he decided to become something. So he tried real hard for a real long time. And all he could do is make himself into a little bit of gas, which was really an effort when you're nothing. It's a pretty good accomplishment. But Mother Nothing was disappointed. And she said to Son Nothing, I think that stinks. Why don't you do something other than just becoming some gas? So, Son Nothing got angry and exploded, flew everything through everywhere for millions of years, and finally Mother Nothing said, why don't you settle down? So it settled down, and here we are now. That's more or less a summary of history. But actually, that's not really science. That's more like science fiction. Because it has nothing to do with anyone's real experience. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita explains that everything is coming from the Supreme Person, the original person. He has different names, whether Allah, Jehovah, Krishna, whatever. But there's this original Supreme Person. And how do we know that? From our own experience. Just like all of us had a father and mother. Isn't that right? And our fathers and mothers had a father and mother. And our fathers and mothers, grandparents, had fathers and mothers. They all had fathers and mothers. So the question is, who's the original father and mother? There must have been an original one. Because all of us we've come from fathers and mothers. Now the scientists say originally there was nothing, and from that nothing, everything came. So why doesn't more things come out of the nothing? Why did it stop? Because it was nothing, and when it became something, it used up all its nothingness. There's nothing left after it became something. But it was nothing to begin with. So our understanding is that everything came from something. And when the original someone must have had all the qualities we have, otherwise why do we have any qualities? If we have some beauty, if we have some knowledge, if we have some strength, we have some wealth, we have some renunciation, we have some fame, then the person from which everything comes from must also have unlimited wealth. They must have wealth, fame, beauty, knowledge, renunciation, strength. Must have everything we have, but to an unlimited degree, that's where we're all getting our little bit of wealth, of beauty, or fame, or knowledge, or renunciation. So the question is, why in Bhagavad Gita are we now not aware of that? Why? Because we're trying to be something we're not. And we're trying to imagine that this body that we're in and the senses we have, they're actually the most important thing in the whole universe. However limited it may be, still we're imagining that we're the center of the universe. and therefore we're allowed to think like that by illusion. Although we know it's not true, but we'd like to imagine it's true, and we'd like to live life after life trying to be the center of some people's attention, someone's attention, and therefore we forget about who's actually the center of the universe. Just like, for instance, to give an example, that the scientists, they can create, you know, what can, every day we see the sun rising in the sky, and exactly at a certain time the sun sets at a certain time. Now, how did that happen? We can say it came about by accident, or we can say that there was a person who created it and arranged it. Now, if we say it's just an accident, then we have to say how the accident happened. Because even accidents have causes behind them. If two cars crash into the street, and then the police come and ask, how did it happen? And if someone says it happened by accident, then the police want to know how the accident happened. So if we see the sun rising at a certain time, and the sun setting at a certain time, then we have to ask, how has this happened? The sun, which is full of infinite effulgence and heat and light, how is it that it's exactly in an orbit? For instance, if you take, in India they have bulls, and they attach the bull to a, through its nose, they put a ring in its nose, they attach the ring to a pole, and the bull walks around the pole pulling a very heavy weight in order to crush grains. Now the bull is so powerful that it can pull a weight that would take 50 strong men to pull. But although the bull is so powerful, it cannot move one inch beyond the rope. So similarly, although the sun is so powerful, it's lighting up the whole universe with heat and providing with light and heat, still it doesn't move one inch beyond its orbit. So what's keeping the sun exactly in an orbit? If the sun moved a little closer to the earth, everything would burn up. And if it moved a little further away, everything would freeze. And yet every day we know this sun's going to rise up and set exactly on time. We have no idea what time we're going to get up with all our intelligence. We don't even know what time we're going to go to sleep tonight. And we consider ourselves very intelligent. So how is it that the most biggest thing we can see in the universe, the closest to us, is being moved in exact orbit? Even the people in Switzerland who make watches, all they can do is try to imitate the movement of the sun. With all their intelligence, they imperfectly try to create something as precise as the movement of the sun, which they're not able to do. So they're intelligent, they're creating watches to figure out what the movements of the sun are. So who created the biggest watch in the universe? So we understand there's a person behind it. There's a person who created it, because it takes a person to have such intelligence. The only problem is, with that explanation, is that most people are envious of the Creator. Therefore they want to deny His existence. That such a person could exist, could create all these planets, all these stars and the moon and the sun. He can create things like a machine. For instance, if a person could create a male Rolls Royce and a female Rolls Royce, and if they can get together, then they can make little Rolls Royces. That would be quite a good machine, wouldn't it? Then everyone could have a Rolls Royce. You just feed a little oil, it grows up, and you get a big Rolls Royce. But the scientists can't do that. But Krishna, God, the Supreme Person, He's created male machines and female machines and 8,400,000 species of life. And when they get together, they make little machines, and they grow up, and they make more machines. That if the scientists can make a machine, you put grass in one end, and at the other end you can get milk. That would be a very good, nice machine. You just mow your lawn and you get gallons of milk. But the scientists can't do that. But Krishna has did that. He's made a machine. It's called the cow. You put milk in one end, and the other end you get milk. You put grass in one end, the other end you get milk. So the point is, with some intelligence, we can understand there's an existence of a Supreme Person. And if we follow his instructions, he's giving us instructions to realize our eternal identity and our relationship with the Supreme. In other words, eternally everyone has a relationship with the Supreme, whether or not we are conscious of it or not. Without the sun, we can't exist. Without the rain, we can't exist. But we're not creating these things. They're being provided to us by Supreme Intelligence. So everyone has this relationship, consciously or unconsciously, with the Supreme. And the Bhagavad Gita is simply meant to help us wake up to what that relationship is and how to revive it in a positive way. Right now, everyone's trying to deny Krishna's existence, and Maya illusion is providing us intelligence by which we can continuously do that. Act as if there is no Krishna, there is no God. And the result is we're bewildered. We're being advertised, like this is Christmas, we're being advertised, if you buy this or you buy that, then you'll become happy. If you get this or you get that, you'll become happy. So if that was true, then the richest people in the world would be the happiest. But we don't find that. Because, number one, they also have to leave their body. And when they leave their body, they also have to leave everything that they accumulated, that they become attached to. And therefore, they become most unhappy when they have to give it up. And they don't know where they're going. Matter of fact, anyone in illusion, after leaving this body, they have no idea where they're going next. And if we are not this body, then we are going somewhere. So it would be interesting to find out where we're going after we leave this body. So those questions are answered in the Bhagavad Gita, what the laws of karma are, what the laws of reincarnation are, who the Supreme Person is, what time is, what this material energy is, who we are, and how it's all working. So those who are intelligent, they'll study Bhagavad Gita, try to apply in their lives to experience what Bhagavad Gita is talking about. Otherwise, Merry Christmas. So I'll stop there. Any questions or comments? So today is the day this is the day that Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita to his friend Arjuna. So it's a special day for us for the Bhagavad Gita. And today we recited this whole book, 700 verses in Slovene, because it's translated to like 70 languages. So we recited all the verses that we in Slovene today. And every day we have these classes, and we talk about the same thing every day, but it never gets boring. It proves it's spiritual. All right. Thank you very much. Grandharaj Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai.